Well, what we want to look at this morning is, again, true spirituality. As I mentioned before, this I'm taking from my meditations on the book by Dr. Francis Schaeffer called True Spirituality. And he said the question before us is what the Christian life, true spirituality, really is and how it may be lived in the 20th century. And I added in the 21st century as well, setting freedom from the bondage of sin. And we're looking today at basic considerations, the law of Moses and the law of love. It was a great awakening for me for a number of years. I would spend every December preaching on Christmas themes. And there's no end to that because, in one sense, that's the whole message of the gospel, that Christ came and he came to die. He came in human flesh. All of this is the great work of the gospel. And then on January, I would preach on stewardship, just basically to get it out of the way so we didn't have to do it the rest of the year. And then on February, Valentine's Day month, I'd preach on love. Well, getting through this and repeating myself and finding out what the Bible said about it here, there, and everywhere, I began to recognize, slowly but surely, a concentration that this is what God is all about. I came to this conclusion because, as we'll point out in 1 John 4, verse 8 and 16, he says, God is love. And this is an amazing statement. This is far different from statements like God is true and God is holy, because it is not saying that he is loving, you see, or lovely. It is not an adjective like these others. It is a noun. He is love. This is equating God with love. And not just any kind of love, not just a slight affection, like we use the term love. Oh, I love that couch, you know, stuff like that. This is the particular love that he showed us. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son to die for us. This is that self-sacrificing idea that is the heart of who God is. And so we see God is love, and then Christ summarized the law and the prophets for us by saying, it is summarized by love the Lord with all your heart and mind and soul and strength. And the second commandment is like unto that, love your neighbor as yourself. And so God is love and God asks love. Well, that's pretty central, isn't it? If you study the Old Testament deeply enough, if you skim over it, you recognize that there's a lot of laws, a lot of commandments. God seems very threatening. God seems very touchy about these things. But when you get into it in depth, you begin to see what Christ said is absolutely true, which we wouldn't have doubted, and that is that God did this because he loves us, and we'll get into that a little bit here. But this is the great theme. I have come to this conclusion that the way to summarize God's relationship with man is that he created man to invite him to be a part of his loving family. God didn't lack anything. God is completely sufficient. Before there was creation, before he did anything, he was completely at ease and satisfied. In fact, he was so satisfied, he said, I would like to share this with other beings, but looking around, I'm the only one. I'm the only one that exists. So he created beings, the angels and humans, and he made them in the image of God, not the angels. Man is in the image of God. That's not said of the angels. But in one sense, they're superior to us, and in another sense, we become greater than them. We will actually judge angels. Okay, I'm starting to ramble here, I think. But anyway, the point here is that God, the adoption picture is perhaps the most central of what this is all about, that God wanted to adopt. And of course, this is terminology that wouldn't have made sense until he created and had people, and there were such things as adoptions and all that. So he's borrowing from our experience so that we can understand what he was dealing with. But to bring us into his holy family, to call us sons, like he calls his son Jesus a son, to actually enter into that relationship and to do so out of love. And then to warn us that going our own way might seem right, but it will lead us into death. It's kind of a dwindling death. When he created us and when he made us in the womb of our mother, at the moment we gained life, he gave us a life that never ends. Never ends. Now, when Christ was talking to the living people that he was preaching to, he said, "Come unto me, you might have life, and more abundantly." So he was talking to living people, but he was saying, you don't know it, but you don't have full life. You have only a semblance of life. You have a dwindling life, a wasting away life. This is what sin pictures for us. It is we are born spiritually dead, and we continue to rot away morally, intellectually, and so on, until finally the body dies. But the life that we have continues on, and yet without God, there is no renewal. And so that life dwindles down and becomes less. And finally, withdrawn from the very presence of God, we end up in hellfire. How that connects with the dwindling, I haven't worked that out yet. But adoption is the plea. I have made all the arrangements, he says. I have paid the great price of the blood of my son that will allow you to become one of my family. Please ask to be one of my family. Come join my family. Perfect, loving relationship forever. And if we could understand how wonderful that it is, we would do whatever it took to get saved. But nothing we can actually do. We just say yes. So the law of Moses and the law of love is perhaps the greatest distinction that we need. We find that throughout history, Christianity has been devolved down into a religion. And this is like the religions of man, because man thinks that they've got this religion thing down. You do a bunch of stuff, and then you're okay with God, or whoever you're calling God. And they keep trying to twist Christianity into a religion. So we're going to be looking then at basic considerations, the law of Moses, the law of love. First of all, becoming a Christian, and then being a Christian. And two concepts here. Getting a little warm. I'm going to turn on my little fan here. Well, my borrowed fan. Becoming a Christian is free. Being a Christian can be hard. Because what happened is that when we became adopted, we're not ready to be taken into his family yet. We are all deformed and twisted by sin, and he wants us to have the beauty of holiness. He wants us to become like his natural son, Jesus, to become conformed to the image of Christ. And so all the evil twisting of sin in us, the practice of sin, the practice of thinking in sin that we've that we've practiced all the way up until the time we got saved, that has to change, that needs to change. And so what he does for us, and the quote in the bulletin today is a kind of a summary of James chapter 1, saying that the trials and the hardships that he gives us has a purpose. And if you were to opt out, you know, rub the genie lamp and said, I don't want any more problems, then you just stay the way you are. You wouldn't face problems. You wouldn't gain patience, endurance. You wouldn't gain the virtues that he has for you. So you think about being born. Being born is an important beginning, but it's just a beginning. As with physical birth, our new birth is at once the most important part and the least important part of our life. It is the most important because we would have no life without it, but it is least important because all of life develops after that. I mentioned before a thing that was shocking to me. I was in a person's home working for my dad, trying to sell home improvements. And he and I were in a home, and it had a box built in the corner of the living room. It was a wooden wall about maybe foot and a half high, and it was filled with blankets and looked like pillows and stuff. So the guy didn't explain it, and I didn't ask. Maybe a playroom for big dog or something. I don't know what it was. And then some of the blankets started moving, and there was something in there. And he said, excuse me, that's my son. And he was, I think, as I remember, he was in his early 20s at the time, but had never developed. He couldn't feed himself, couldn't do anything. He basically stayed right there and was comfortable. They fed him and took care of him, changed his diaper, all these things. Birth can be a great blessing, and normally is, but if there's no development, it can be such a tragedy because of the loss of potential. So we dare not allow the thought, well, I'm saved, so now that's done. Now that's over. What should we think? Well, there's a poor way to advance. What's the poor way? Follow this list of thou shalt nots. I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't chew, I don't go with the girls that do. You know that old saying? And the thing is, that'll make you a cleaner person, make you a better person, but it doesn't help you with God. A rich way to advance is grow and develop. Grow and develop. And this is my heart goal for each of you, as well as myself. True spirituality, then, is a positive and not merely a set of negatives. People say, I don't want to be a Christian, there are too many negatives, you see. Well, there's a whole lot of positives that if you follow that, the negatives kind of drop away. To conceive of the Christian life as a set of taboos is to relegate it to the average human religion. You sign up for a religion, you ask, well, what are the things we can't do now? So can't drink, or what are the Mormons? You can't drink coffee or tea or any of those things. If they can't have tea, you know it has to be a false religion, right? That's my go-to drink. And yet, on the other hand, the people who are raging against a list of taboos may actually be arguing against having any restrictions upon their will. This is also anti-Christian. Our will is to be submissive to God. And so we add what he, you know, we strive after what he asks us to do. And we stay away from the things that he said, don't do it. That's actually this is the law of God brought in and understood as the love of God. Let me explain. Grow as a Christian. Develop your new Christian life by grasping the value of God's instructions. David was like that. If you can imagine, God said, and you know David did many, many terrible things. He was treacherous. His own, one of his great men of valor. He had relations with his wife while he was out fighting, and then sent him to his death deliberately so that he could seem the good guy and marry this poor widow. Horrible things. But God said that he was going to make him a king because he was a man after his own heart. What was going on there is that David, while as a working as a shepherd, a lowly position, he took it seriously. He learned how to throw the sling and hit with the rod and so on. He actually fought a lion that had caught one of the lambs, and he grabbed it by the beard and whacked it with a stick until it let the lamb go, and took off, saying, "This guy's crazy. I'm going to get out of here." So he took the job seriously. Then it always seems to me that the hardest job to stay awake would be counting sheep, right? Wouldn't that be tough? And so he's sitting there watching the sheep, just protecting them, making sure they eat the right stuff and not the bad stuff. So he learned to play. He got one of these handheld harps and the lyre, and he began to play with it. And he thought, well, I ought to sing something. So what he did is he memorized all of the scripture. I evidently had a lot of time on his hands. He memorized the first five books of the Bible, the whole Bible in his day. He memorized every word of the Bible in Hebrew. Of course, that was his language. But he memorized that and then thought about it and then sang about it. The Psalms are God's working in his life. He began to say, he doesn't want me to kill. What does that say about him? Well, he's a God that gives life and loves life and wants life protected, you see. And he began to ask, what kind of a God is he that tells me to do these things and not to do these others? And that led him to know God, not just what God said he can't do. So if we go back to the beginning, when God gave only one commandment, he gave it in love. I want you to listen, Genesis 2:17. I had to come back to this verse because reading the Reformed writers for so long, they said this was the first law that he enacted, and they broke the law, and they had to pay the penalty and so on. And I began to listen to this as if I were saying it to somebody, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. This was a warning, wasn't it? This is a saying. Now, I'm going to tell you, you could eat all the trees except for that one, and here's why. This is bad for you, see. And so, when they doubted God's love, and so then they doubted his warning, you know, like the person who says, he says don't do that, I don't think that's so bad. You doubt his love, you doubt his warning, they eat of the forbidden fruit. Adam and Eve, along with all the children that they would ever produce, the entire human race, began to die. Old age, as I can testify, is a warning sign of approaching death. Recognize then that God's laws are not a path to salvation. They are a path to a wiser and healthier life. If you are an unsaved person who keeps God's law, your life is going to be better off than a saved person who violates God's law. Because your life is what the law is all about, how to live a better life. God's love is behind every law. This was brought to me very forcefully in Deuteronomy after giving Moses and Israel the Ten Commandments a second time. Deuteronomy means Deutero second and nomos the law, Deuteronomy, second giving of the law. He gave it in Exodus, he gave it Exodus 20, he gave the Ten Commandments. And then they had this whole fiasco where they wouldn't go in and they refused to go in, they were too scared. And so he says, all right, 40 years of wilderness wanderings and this generation will die off. So now Israel, the next generation, comes and they are ready to come into the promised land. And there he stops and he says, let's review. And here is the giving in Deuteronomy 5, giving of the Ten Commandments again. Now, after he gave those Ten Commandments again, God sort of sits down with Moses and talks to him about it. In Deuteronomy 5:29, oh, that there were such a heart in them that they would fear me and keep all my commandments always. And that, you could understand, God gave the commandments, God said, keep them. And then he explains why he wishes that, oh, that there was such a heart in them. He says that it might be well with them and with their children forever. Why did he give the laws? That it would be well with them and with their children. He said if they could raise their children according to these laws, it'll be better for the children. All around this country, they're chasing down children traffickers that are stealing children, selling them in prostitution. Indiana, Illinois, had a big sweep. All over the nation, this was happening. Then again, as I said, Jesus summarized all of the law and the prophets. Prophets preaching, Matthew 22:37-40. And Jesus said unto him, the man who asked the question, what's the greatest commandment? He says, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. And then he says, on these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Made me think of a mobile. You know, it's hanging by one strand, and then it branches off and has all these things that come off of it. I made one when Kathleen was born, our first baby. And so I thought, well, it'd be nice to put things up there and maybe lay in the crib and have something to look at. And so I made it out of coat hanger wire and so on, and taped it up to the thing, came in, the baby stopped cooing or whatever, and came in, the thing had fallen down, was laying all over the baby. So I said, okay, not a good idea. We were renting the house. We didn't want to pound a nail into the ceiling. So I set it aside. Good idea, but it was fun to make. But the idea of trying to balance it all. But the thing is, you have one coming down, and then it branches into two parts. And then from those two parts, all the other things hang and depend. And that's what he's saying, that you have love God and love your fellow man, and all the other laws develop from that. All the laws are dealing with how to love God, how to express that love, and how to love your fellow man, how to express that. And the one thread that's hanging it all is love. Loving God, loving man, this is love. This is God is love. He's telling us how to do this, how to do it his way, not to have this warm, fuzzy feeling about these things, but to give yourself unrestrictedly to it. So when you and I are irritated with others, we might ask, why should I love my neighbor? Am I my brother's keeper? It's not my turn to watch him, you know. I don't want to do this. But in the final analysis, it's not about what you think of them. It's what you think of God. We love and serve others. Why? Because they're so loving? Because they deserve it so much? No. Because we love and serve God. And he asks us to love them. That's our duty before God. So we adopt that attitude, even if we don't like those people. Even if they're mean to us. Galatians 5:13. For brethren, we have been called into liberty, only use not liberty for an occasion of the flesh. That would be hurting others. But by love, serve one another. Serve here is to be to slave for them. But your motive is love, doing the best for them, not just giving them anything they want. That's not a good thing. So Jesus told us that this is the essence of true spiritual discipleship. How do you grow close to God? How do you enter into the discipline of Christ? He said in Luke 9:23, he said to them all, "If any man will come after me, let him deny himself," what he wants to do, build himself up, "and take up his cross daily and follow me." Sacrifice yourself to yourself and give yourself to others. The cross that Jesus asks us to take up, if you can imagine symbolically, the cross on the wall behind me, you have one great vertical and then you have a cross piece. This cross is grounded firmly here in reality, pounded into the ground, and it points straight up to God. It's where we live, it's where we exist, it's where we live and breathe and have our being, and it's pointing us straight to God. But then there's the added piece, you see. He saved me by the unthinkable sacrifice of his beloved Son. And so I love him. And he asks me to love others as he loved me. And my love for him means I can't resist his loving request. Why do I live like I live? Why do I do what I do? Why do I not do what others do? Because he asked me to. The cross piece points left and right. It reminds me to love others. Those, all of those. This includes my brothers and sisters in Christ, and it even includes my persecuting enemies. So we will take special care to refrain from hurting our brethren. Paul writes of this in Romans 14:15. He said, "You're eating whatever you want right in front of the people that it'll hurt them. If they do what you're doing, they don't understand they have a freedom. They think they're sinning, and you're encouraging them to sin. But if thy brother be grieved with thy meat, with your food, now walkest thou not charitably." You're not walking according to love. "Destroy not him with your meat for whom Christ died." Again, in 1 Corinthians, he wrote this to the Romans and then to the Corinthians. "But when ye sin so against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Wherefore, if meat, if food, make my brother to offend, I will eat no flesh, I will eat no meat while the world standeth, lest I make my brother to offend." He says, I'll become a vegetarian before I offend my brother. You go to that extreme. And then we will take Christ's threefold response to our enemies. Matthew 5:44. "But I say unto you, love your enemies." What does that mean? Well, number one, bless them that curse you. What does cursing mean? Say bad things about you. What do? Say good things to them, about them. We fight words with words. They're bad words, we fight with good words. Bless them. Secondly, do good to them that hate you. They just hate you. He says, well, see if you could change that by doing good to them. That's what the Apostle Paul said. If your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him to drink. Find out what they need, if you can. And be the one to give them. And thirdly, maybe it's beyond you doing anything, pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. When they are persecuting you, perhaps the only contact you'll have is through God. And so pray. Pray for them. Not just pray that God will get them, you know. But pray for them. Pray lovingly for them. So God is love. 1 John 4:8 and 16. He that loveth not knoweth not God. Why? Because God is love. If you know God, then you will know the God kind of love. That you love, and he says, verse 16, and we have known and believed the love that God hath to us. God is love, and he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, and God in him. So to be like him, we must become love, the God kind of love. God love is self-sacrifice for the good of others. Jesus pointed this out, John 13:34 and 15, 9 and 12. A new commandment I give unto you, that you love one another. But then he expands that by saying, as I have loved you, that you also love one another. Now, while he was alive, they knew how he loved them. But after his death, they understood all the more. I love you enough to die for you, and I will die for you. 15:9, as the Father hath loved me, so have I loved you. He's passing that love on. Continue ye in my love. And then verse 12, this is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. This is that God kind of love, the self-sacrifice love. It is love to get the best for the person, even if it costs me dearly. John tells us, 1 John 4:11 and 19, beloved, if God so loved us, if God loved us in that manner, we ought also to love one another. And then we love him because he first loved us. We respond to that love. So true spirituality then is ultimately an inward development. Not you doing, not you marching, not you giving. That's, you know, beyond, and perhaps a development of the inward, an expression of the inward, but the actual development, the actual true spirituality, is an inward development. We find this even in the Ten Commandments. I was interested to notice that the Tenth Commandment, Exodus 20, verse 17, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's house, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife, nor his manservant, nor his maidservant, nor his ox, or his ass, or anything that is thine neighbor's. Just don't desire it. He says again, second giving of the law, Deuteronomy 5:21, neither shalt thou desire, he explains what covet is here, neither shalt thou desire thy neighbor's wife, neither shalt thou covet thy neighbor's house, his field, his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, his ass, his anything that is thy neighbor's. Oh, attractive donkey over there. I wish I had that. I wonder if I could lead it over to my land. No, he says, don't do that. Now, if you consider this, you know, thou shalt not steal, that's taking something, but this is a commandment that forbids an entirely inward attitude. This is telling you how not to think, how not to feel. It's an inward attitude. He's asking us to develop inwardly here. And I find it interesting that after of all of this, of all the other ten, this is the commandment that struck conviction in Paul's heart, the Apostle Paul. He explains this in Romans 7, verses 7 to 9. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Oh no, law is great. Nay, I had not known sin but by the law. You say, really? Give me an example. Okay. For I had not known lust, or concupiscence, the desire for more and more and more, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. He said, I was busy not doing those things he told me not to do, but then he said, don't even think that way. Don't desire what others have. But sin, taking occasion by the commandment, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence. He says, I seemed to covet more when I realized I shouldn't be coveting. For without the law, sin was dead. It was dormant within me. But then when it said I couldn't, I said, oh yeah, well, what if I want it? For I was alive without the law once when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. He says, I was not a good person. I was violating one of the Ten Commandments by desiring these things that God said, don't do that. An inward attitude. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus filled the Ten Commandments with their essentially inward meanings. Let me do this quickly. Thou shalt not kill. I'll give you three examples. Matthew 5:21, you have heard that it was said by them or to them of old, thou shalt not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. He says, that's good, but what that means is that you could take the knife and run up to the person and do, you know, actually stick it in their skin above their heart, and as long as you didn't kill them, it was okay. You could hate them to the utmost. But he said, no, let me fill this full. Matthew 5:22, next verse. But I say unto you that whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. Whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, which means vain fellow. You're calling them worthless, shall be in danger of the council. Whoever shall say, thou fool, shall be in danger of hellfire. Do you see how broad thou shalt not kill means? He says, don't even wish them ill. Don't be angry. Don't call them names. Do we let that slip? Do we let that go? Maybe we didn't say it out in front of their face. We're talking to somebody else about them. Maybe we did. And he said, if that was unhindered, you would kill them. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Matthew 5:27. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, thou shalt not commit adultery. But he goes on, verse 28, and then explaining in 31 to 32. But I say unto you, that whosoever looketh on a woman to lust. Now, men have to look at women all the time, you see. But for what purpose? Don't look at them to lust after her. He says, if you do that, you have committed adultery with her already in his heart. She might be completely innocent of all of this, just you in your heart. He explains it has been said, whosoever shall put away or divorce his wife, that's what put away means, let him give her a writing of divorcement. Just, sorry, you're gone. But I say unto you, whosoever shall put away or divorce his wife, saving except for the cause of fornication, he says, if you don't divorce a person for this one reason that I give you, you cause her to commit adultery. And whosoever shall marry her that is divorced committeth adultery. He says, if it's not a God-sanctioned divorce, then you're still married, and yet you're living with other people. You got remarried. And then the last one is, thou shalt not bear false witness. Matthew 5:33. Again, you have heard that it's been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself. Swear, one thing is true, but it's not. Thou shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. Now, you have to understand that they had secret oaths that did not really bind them to tell the truth. They were like children to keep their fingers crossed while telling a lie. Because if they said, I swear by my left hand, that meant it didn't have to be true. But the stranger didn't know that. The foreigner didn't have to know that. See, this is a genuine opal. I swear by my mother's beard, you know, and they make something up. He says, no, don't do that. But I say to you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, I swear by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king, neither shalt thou swear by thy head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black. You can't control your head. But let your communication be yea, yea. If you say yes, let it mean yes, and nay, nay. If you say no, it can't really mean yes, you say. It has to mean no. For whatsoever is more than these, simple meaning, if it's more complicated than that, it cometh of evil. So my purpose in this message is to say that the law of Moses is not a series of things to keep you on your path to heaven, but wisdom of life given out of love and you show your obedience to God because you love him, and you show that obedience by loving others. You don't hurt others. You don't kill them. You don't get angry. You don't call them names. You try to bolster, try to edify, try to fulfill their life to what is possible. Comments or questions? Additions? Humorous anecdotes? Anything? Anything? Okay. Yes?
I saw a deer yesterday coming back from the retreat. But I didn't think, I wish I had a bow and arrow or a gun or something, I could shoot that deer. For one thing, we were on the road, so it's illegal to shoot the road. Mm-hmm. But the other thing was, it was beautiful and it wasn't causing any trouble and I wasn't sorry.
Okay.
But I did think about it later.
Mm-hmm.
And they think, to get that, I'm going to have to kill it and drag it home.
Yeah.
But all I did was slow down and let it go
past. Yeah. He fulfilled the old law by filling it full of its inward meaning. All right, let's stand together. We'll be dismissed with prayer. Our Father, we thank you for being love, which is the description that you gave of yourself and revealed to us. And we recognize that all of the law and the prophets are aimed at getting us to love you and to love others, to imitate you, to be loving as you are loving, to love as you love, to seek the best even if it takes from us. We think of the needs of the Pizarros and soon probably of the Gonzalez family. And if there's something we could do, if there's something we could give, we ask that you might allow us to be loving in these regards. Would you help us then to be reminded at the time that we seek to violate your law, that we're seeking to take things into our own hands and do things for ourselves rather than being a servant one to another? We ask that you might help us then to see the true spiritual growth, true spirituality is the inward development. We pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.